Welcome to Argyle Chat, the Plymouth Argyle podcast brought to you by the Herald Sports Desk.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of Argyle Chat. Joining me this week is Jack Ball. Hiya, Jack.
Hello.
And a very special welcome to our guest, Rory Fallon. Hi, Rory.
How's it going? You all right?
Yeah, good, thank you. Lovely, hot, sunny day. We expected you to be out selling ice creams.
Well, I've been eating ice cream this morning. About 9 o'clock.
We had a look on the website, didn't we, beforehand? We saw your title as Chief Taster.
Yeah, it's changed now. Like, I am Chief Taster. That's like, I'll always be that. I'm making now, so... because I've stopped playing football, I've got more time to actually make the stuff now.
Oh, really?
So yeah.
Wow.
So if you eat the Cowlick ice cream, it's either made by me or Carly. We've got another person as well helping us.
Fantastic.
So when it comes to doing the ice cream, do you sort of experiment yourself and try new flavours?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah,
constantly, like, just changing flavours. That's where we found our niche, really, was because we can make any flavour you want. Mm. So... we've got it to a place now where if someone told us, can you make that? We can make it straight away. We'll just know what to do, you know?
Yeah, what's your personal favourite?
Lime and tequila.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so refreshing.
Wow.
It's beautiful in the summer when it's nice and hot and that. That's a sorbet. My probably favourite at the moment would be ice cream would be probably a Biscoff marshmallow or... we got one called Baccio, which is a hazelnut chocolate, and another one, Caramac, which is a, have you ever had one of those Caramac chocolate bars? Yeah, it tastes like that, yeah.
Oh, okay. So how do you try them out? Once you've got a flavour, do you take them out and test them a little bit, or?
Yeah, we'll test them. Usually we bang them out straight away. We've got to a stage now where it doesn't take ages to work it out. We know pretty much, that's what's, in our head, we know what we need to put in. With stuff like chocolate sorbets and stuff, it takes a little bit of tweaking, and the sorbets are the ones that take longer to make. So the ice cream's already made up, and then you start adding stuff to it. Mm. The sorbets you have to completely make from scratch, so it takes a bit longer. But it's just one of them things. It's weird because I've football every day and now it's ice cream every day, so it's my life is just completely turned 360.
So could you ever imagine you'd have done something like this when you were playing? Is this totally unexpected?
No, because I think with every footballer the next path is coaching. Mm. Especially with my dad being a coach, but I know what it entails because growing up with my dad. And I know it's not a long shelf life. I know that there's not many jobs. And when you do get that job, you've probably got 3 games to keep that job. So I know it's very fickle. And I just know what my dad's been through to be coaching for that long in New Zealand. I know what it entails. And it completely takes over your life. Mm. Football has completely taken over my life since I was born. Because straight away I was... pretty much thrusted into football because my dad. I've enjoyed really having a complete break from it. I've got all my coaching badges and stuff like that. But at the moment, I'm just having a hiatus away from football, just complete break.
Do you miss it at all?
No.
Really?
People think I'm mad, but they're not in it every day. They just watch it and they talk about it, but they'll never know until they're actually in it. Great memories, you never forget the memories and all that stuff, and I'm really proud of what I achieved, but I got to a stage where I was just I've had enough of being on the bus and being in a hotel room, a different bed, living out of a suitcase, being on planes. I just got sick of it. I played for 18 professional years,
good
it was a long time.
I asked because I heard Steven Gerrard recently say that he wishes he had played for another year longer at Liverpool because he can never go back now. But
I think you find a lot of footballers that you either get the footballers that can't wait to leave it, and you'll get the footballers that will just wish they can still play again and they can't let the game go. And for me, that's the worrying bit for people, the ones that can't let go of the game. Those are the guys that get depressed. because it's massive now for people leaving the game and getting all depressed and stuff like that. I don't want to be that statistic and have... I had a vision that I would like either get my coaching badges and go into stepping straight into a job, or what I really wanted was a business that I could fall into straight after football. Because what happens is that footballers, they stop and then they like twiddle their thumbs and wonder, what do I do now? And then they just get into bad habits, really. They're bad habits that they had as a footballer, they take into, you know, after life, after, you know, football life. So I didn't want to be one of them guys, you know. I wanted to have something where I could go straight into and just, you know, I mean, get into it and just, you know, completely do something different.
So when did you have the business sort of lined up and ready to go into?
I had the business when I was at Scunthorpe, so 3 years ago. I did, when I was playing for Scunthorpe, I did my cruciate. So the, you know, the specialists and the doctors were saying I'll be out for over a year. It became 16 months. So there and then I was like with my wife, okay, we're going to start the business up now.
I guess at that sort of age as well, you know.
I was 33. Yeah. So I was like, it was a great time for me to say, okay, time to start thinking about the next phase. I'd got my UEFA badge and stuff like that. But really at the time I was like, don't want to be coaching.
Is there much help with that in football? Do you get many people saying you should think about what you want to do next, or are you sort of left to do it on your own?
You'll get PFA reps come in. The PFA were massive help. They're brilliant. You know, they're paid at the time when I was at Scunthorpe. What happened? I did my cruciate. Scunthorpe paid for that because I was playing for them. Then I was out of contract, but they still let me train there and get rehab. Got back, and then I did my meniscus. So I had a double whammy, really. Scunny didn't want to pay for my meniscus because I wasn't signed to them, which is fair enough. And then the PFA paid for my surgery. So, you know, they do stuff like after football, you know, they'll put you into programs like being a plumber and an electrician. So there's stuff there for people. I think just with footballers, they're really lazy.
Yeah.
And all they know is football, and that's all they want to do. And then they think they're going to be playing football for their whole lives. And then you know, football, like you could sign for 2 seasons and then next season you don't have a contract.
Yeah.
And you fall out of the game pretty quick. And then they haven't got anything. So I just knew, the scenario of, you know, what was going off around me. And especially at that age, the contracts were getting smaller. The time was getting smaller. So I saw it. But the big thing that happened was around when we went into administration with Plymouth Argyle. Because around that time we were on really good contracts and like life was great, you know, doing the game, you know, playing the game I love, you know, great contract. And then all of a sudden the carpet's taken from under you and you're not getting paid anything. That was like the moment where it struck home. So that's when I started doing the badges and that. And then a few years later did the business.
It must be quite hard as well mentally for, I don't know, players to be playing in front of thousands of people and then being a plumber fixing their toilet, for example. It must be sort of hard to get your head around not living that life anymore.
Yeah, it's just one of them things that if you don't prepare, you know, because I didn't have an excuse. I had a good career, you know, I've had a long career and I had a good chance to save money up and stuff like that. You know, whenever I moved to a club, I tried to buy a house instead of, you know, I never tried to lease stuff, and I always tried to invest well as well. So I had things to show for my career, whereas some people, you know, I've got mates who don't have anything.
Yeah.
Complete, just nothing. And they start from scratch and they have to do a job that they hate.
And I suppose they probably live the high life as well while they're earning decent money.
Well, that's the thing. When you're young, you got all this money, you got all this time, and you think you're the big man, and then then your contract's gone, and you're like, uh-oh.
What do I do now?
What do I do now? Instead of saving the money. So, you know, I'm not saying I'm perfect. When I was younger, I did have that time where I was living like that, but, you know, you know, there was a couple of things that changed me and I was like, you know what, I've got to just get my head screwed on because it's not a you know, long shelf life being a footballer.
Did your dad help with that as well? Because obviously he'd been...
Do you know, my dad was always one of them guys, like, always invest in property. He was like, if you ever do anything, invest in property. And that was like a big thing for me. So one of my targets, you know, I always had like little targets, not just football targets, I had life targets, you know, and I always wanted to own my own house outright. That was one of my main goals. And a few years back, I did that. So that was one of my main goals, to do that. And I did it. And it was, you know, it was a great feeling, you know.
Yeah, indeed. Well, obviously, you came down to Argyle, Ian Holloway, it was, of course, that boy.
Ollie, yeah.
Yeah. 4 years at Argyle. How did the move come about, and what was Ollie like to work with? Obviously, he comes across to the, you know, people that don't know him as a bit of a comedy figure. Was he fun to work under?
It was good, yeah. I enjoyed being with Ollie. I remember at the time, though, when I left Swansea, I think I was one of the biggest signings for Plymouth, so... it was a strange one because I went to came to Plymouth on you know big signing and that, and then I was on the bench for a while because obviously our team was flying. Mm-hmm. I came into a team that was, you know, around knocking around the playoffs, the championship, so I just had to really bide my time. But I had absolutely no complaints with Ollie. He was a guy that could get an average team and average players to perform to their peak. Not saying that our team was average, that was a very good team, that championship team that we had. He was a character.
I mean, you mentioned the fact that you came in to be, and you had to bide your time. Is that hard as a footballer, especially for a striker?
Yeah, it's one of them. As a striker, you know, any striker will say is like you need to know that you're playing so you can get your hit, so you, and then scoring as well. Once you start, thing is, I scored straight away when I came to Plymouth, you know, against West Brom. But it took me a while to actually break into the team because the lads were flying. When you go to a team and they're doing well in the winning games, you can't really complain.
Yeah.
Because end of the day, the team was flying.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really have any complaints, really.
We talk about that now with Derek Adams. He only plays one striker up front, and you've got Ryan Taylor who plays up front. And we talked about before how it must be hard to try and recruit another striker when they only play one in that position, and whether someone's willing to be the second person.
Yeah, and they know, you know, you're going to have three strikers, aren't you?
Yeah,
because you need three or four strikers. Yeah. So you know, you got a couple of lads who are going to be on the bench sitting there just watching.
If you're a player as well, and Adams comes to you and says, "I want you to come to Plymouth," and you know that Ryan Taylor's already there and he's been the first choice, does that?
I think that'll have a massive effect on the move. For me personally, I wouldn't. As a striker, you want to be playing.
Mm-hmm.
So if the any striker that knows that's the only playing one up front, and for me personally, I'd go to the place that they're playing two up front. At least you've got a chance to get on, because you might not even come on.
And you see, obviously, with strikers, they come on for the last 5-10 minutes, and you're not, that must be hard to make an impact.
Yeah, it's hard. You need 20 minutes, you know, you need to get into the game and stuff like that. So, like, you could be coming on 10 minutes, that's not, you know, I mean, you're going to struggle to even get a touch.
Yeah.
But obviously, people are different. You know, you'll probably get strikers in that are needing an opportunity. That's probably where it'd be going. I don't think you'd get bona fide starting strikers there because they would expect to come in and play.
Yeah. Was that a disappointment then when Ollie left Argyle? Because obviously, as you say, the team were flying at the time. You were challenging for the playoffs, weren't you?
Massive. I think we would have been knocking on the playoff door for Premier League, I think, if we stayed. 100%. No doubt about it. And then what happened was there was the exodus, really, when Paul Sturrock came in. No real fault of his own. It was like a lot of players were coming to the end of their contract. The team had done so well that they were picking up attention from other teams as well.
Mm.
So it was just really a matter of time.
And I think that's obviously when the financial troubles became apparent as well.
I think Ollie probably sniffed it as well that the lads were moving on. And he probably offered them contracts, and they're probably saying, "No, I'm going to wait," because, you know, you're going to, you know, someone like Norris, you at the time you got Ipswich, who's a big team. You know, it's hard to turn down something like that, especially when they're offering you massive wages. As a footballer, you know that you only got a few years to make decent money before you're, you know, making ice cream.
Or running a gym.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, he's doing well with Norris. Yeah. He's got two or three gyms now. So he's one of those guys that has done really well, you know. I've got a couple of friends, actually, I've got one guy called Tim Brown who was on my New Zealand team, and he was way too smart for football. And he couldn't wait to leave football.
Really?
So as soon as he left, he started his own business, and I'm wearing his shoes, actually. His shoe label's called Allbirds, and they've just boomed in America. Oprah Winfrey's wearing the shoes. He's gone massive. I think it was like the guy who invented Google or something like that, invested in his business, and now they're just... He's putting millions and millions into his business, and they're massive now.
You need to get some famous people eating the
we're set up differently, so we can't, you know what I mean? We wouldn't be like that. But, you know, there are some great stories after football that you hear, but I think a lot of the people hear the bad stuff.
Yeah.
People going to prison and all sorts.
Just struggling to cope with.
But there are some people that, you know, are doing really well.
I mean, there was Marvin Morgan's another striker who played for Argyle, and he's got the FEK fashion line that I think is doing pretty well in this country, and he's always snapping pictures of celebrities wearing his stuff as well.
Yeah, there's a few lads that have done well after football, and
well, the good thing with football is that it does give you that opportunity, because as you say, you can make the money, and then if you invest it wisely, you can then have a good career after football.
Where the smart players are. They'll invest their money, and they have got something. They've not fully got their head on it, but they've got it in the background where I'm going to go into that when football finishes. I'm going to try and make as much money as I can, and that's the next phase. Those are the smart ones, and I'd say to any footballer, that's how you've got to be. Because football, you know, there's some people that don't last a year pro. Mm. There's loads of players that have thousands.
And injury as well, you never know if an injury is around the corner.
Anything. Loss of form, it's just, you know, it's, you don't get long in the game.
I mean, just quickly going back to Ian Holloway, I mean, when did you find out that he was leaving? So how did that affect the mood in the camp at the time?
I think the problem with Ollie with that was that he was giving, I've got green blood, and my heart is green and all that kind of stuff. And
sweet and sour green.
The thing is, Ollie, he's a great guy, but he does waffle. He can waffle, you know what I mean? He talks a great game, and I think his talk gets ahead of him. And I think with that, the Argyle fans saw him as like being a genuine guy, you know, I love the, and then as soon as the first thing pops up, he went. And I think that's what really annoyed the fans.
Yeah.
I think the best thing you can do is just stay quiet on the subject, and don't do that. But that was down to him, really. But the lads were gutted, because I think we saw someone that was saying we're going to go to the Premier League, and we actually believed it, and we were actually performing like we were going to the Premier League. And then when he went, it was just like, oh, okay. And then who's coming in now? And then you have disruption. You know, it's very difficult when your team's flying and your coach goes.
Yeah.
So it just messed just the whole... everything up.
I mean the knock-on effect as well, so Holloway leaves, and then you get the likes of, I think, Gosling, Norris, a lot of people leave in January, and the ones that are left could be there thinking, well, I could have got to the Premier League, and that's that chance over. It must be really tough to deal with.
Yeah, we lost you know, some of our best players, you know, and young players as well, you know, whereas if you wanted to kick on, you keep someone like Gosling,
yeah,
to get you to where you need to be.
Yeah.
Just think, we didn't really see we didn't have much foresight on the subject. You know, you only hear rumours, you know, that Ollie wanted a couple of big players to come in to really kick us on to the next level. And then, you know, people saying that the people upstairs wouldn't give them that money. We don't know the finances, you know, we don't know that, you know, we could have been right on the edge of, you know, not having much money anyway to start with. So to do that might have put the club in more trouble. So, and then from then on, it just really started taking a dip.
Yeah.
I think we finished our highest ever position that year.
Was it seventh? Was it? Was it? Was it? but 10th maybe, I can't remember.
It was definitely top 10. I think that was the highest we ever finished, but it was like the disappointment of what could have been.
But I guess from the board's point of view, if they obviously do know the finances, and they obviously knew that things were getting pretty tight, otherwise they perhaps would have taken that gamble to try and get into the Premier League.
But, possibly, yeah. We don't know. We will never know what the situation was. We don't know the reason why Ollie left. I think just everyone was annoyed that, when he was giving up,
He'd sold the dream, hadn't he?
He had sold the dream to everyone. And I think that's what really annoyed everyone. But, you live and you learn. No one's perfect, are they?
No.
And like I said, as well, managers, again, you don't know when they're going to get opportunities. And I think Leicester had quite a lot of money at the time.
But they weren't doing that great. I think they went down.
Yeah, they did. They got relegated in the end, so.
And he took a couple of players with him as well. So, I think at the time he probably realised, what have I done here? But then he went on to get Blackpool, I think, after that. And they went to Premier League. So, end of the day, he's a Premier League manager now. So, end of the day, it's just one of them things. It's a football story, It's just one of them what ifs. I don't really live my life on what ifs. So, what if, Tommy Smith didn't pull the Italian lad in the penalty box? We could have won that game. We would have went to the next round of the World Cup. It's just one of them things you can't.
Quickly spiral if you live by what ifs.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just
can't change the course of history.
Thousands, millions of people, living on what ifs are stuck in the, they're stuck in the past, living in the past, it's just, for me, it's always go forward.
Yeah. What was it like then when Nuggy came in? You said it was a lot different. And as we discussed, players started to go. Obviously, the team broke up. It must have been tough then. It was certainly tough for Nuggy, wasn't it? To have to obviously reduce the wage bill and try and get Argon into some sort of even keel.
And to follow Ian Holloway as well.
I think it was a tough one, that one, because he was successful when he left, went to the Premier League, and then they say never come back to a club.
I think he came back and Argyle was something like fourth or fifth in the league, weren't they? So, as high as they've probably ever been in their entire history.
It was, I doubt Plymouth would ever have got that far up in the league, would they?
No, in the history? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, so he's coming to a club where it's flying, and they're not, it's a difficult one, that one. Very difficult. But I don't think many managers could turn that down, could they, though? Championship, fourth in the league.
I think it was a personal thing as well, because he loved the area. He had his house,
He loved Plymouth
as well, exactly.
There was no doubt that he loved Plymouth. I think he's still living in the area. Yeah. I've got, absolute no complaints about Luggy. When he came in, obviously at the start we weren't seeing eye to eye at the start. Brought in a lot of Scottish players. It's no offence to any Scottish players, but I think there was a thing where he was getting rid of, older players that could have played a little bit longer, like Nallis, Hodgie. There was a few guys, I think even Watsy, I think they could have played a couple more seasons, and they were great people to have in the change room, And then a massive change, and there was loads of players out, loads of players in, and that's what killed it, really. I think he should have just kept the nucleus up there and just added a couple here and there, But that's hindsight. That time was just very difficult for the players to adjust to, because in a football team you have this team, you start with them, you sometimes you get a couple of players in, that's great, but when there's five and six players coming in, just totally disrupts everything, disrupts the flow, disrupts the disharmony. There's disharmony in the camp, and I felt the players that he brought in weren't as good as the players that left. I think that's pretty much the way I saw it.
I think he kind of had to look for those younger players and hope that they could become the players that he'd let go. People like Jamie Mackie, for example. And
that was later on down the line, though, because Jamie Mackie wasn't involved in that championship season. He was I think it was maybe a year after that.
Yeah.
It was people like Sylvain, who was there. It was Barry Hales, it was Norris, it was Nellis, it was Watsy, so it was a team there. that was strong the team spine. That went out. It was a lot of Scottish players that came in. But that's just one of them things. But obviously, it was one of the highest finishes in you know, probably, I don't think there'll be many teams that finished higher up.
No.
It's just one of them things. What if, you know? But yeah, it was difficult for him because obviously they probably didn't have much money. Oh, actually, no, he brought in Steve McLean, didn't he, for 500 grand?
Of course, yeah, record buy.
And then Simon Walton for 750 grand. And then we had Emil Mpenza that came in on who knows what type of money was on. So there was money. Yeah. So what I don't understand is that you buy someone like Simon Walton for 750 grand and we can't get him players, you know, for that Premier League finish.
Yeah.
So it's just one of them things. Yeah. It's like, it was a mess around that time. It's just nice to just forget about it and put it in the past, you know.
Things sadly, Carolyn taking a turn for the worst, didn't they, with Paul Marin, and then they got relegated, and then Peter Reid came in, and that's when the administration really began to take hold.
Yeah, it was just the whole situation of getting rid of Paul as well. The way they treated it was like, it was a bit weird as well. I'm not going to go too much into it but let me just tell you, it was a bit dodgy with the way they got rid of him as well. You know, it wasn't a great way to send Paul off, you know, for what he's done for the club. You know, despite that, you know, what he's done for the club, he's won countless championships for the team, and he got him into the championship. So the way they got rid of him was wrong as well. So there was a lot of stuff that was going off in the background that wasn't helping the team whatsoever.
What about the whole World Cup bit as well? Did that affect the players?
No, I don't think they really paid too much attention to it, but I think they ploughed a lot of money into that.
Yeah.
And I think that probably didn't help. For me, it was a waste of money. At the time, it was a waste of money as well, because it's just one of them things, like, you would have built this massive stadium that you can't fill. Mm. So after the World Cup, when all the dust has settled, you've got a, 30,000-seater, 20,000-seater that, you know, there's only... It's the biggest attendance probably in recent Argyle time of 12,000? So yes, you've got to fill a massive stadium every week.
Darlington, you know, they have that.
Well, the Don.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then obviously MK Dons have kicked on, but I don't think they're filling that stadium.
No,
they've still got that top half that's no one's in there.
Yeah.
So you've got these massive stadiums that are just like, you ain't got the fan base to do it.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was crazy.
Yeah.
I thought you're probably better off spending more like money on getting a new stand, like they should have done at the start. And instead of having three stands, maybe just do the whole stadium in one.
It was a bizarre time because I think they had the Japanese investors that came in as well.
Yeah, that was a nightmare. That was when it really hit the fan.
Mm.
Because they were there just for their own agenda for that World Cup bid. I think they saw there might be some money there to be made or something, and they were just a shambles. They were an utter shambles.
So what's it like to sort of live as a player during all this mess that's going on behind the scenes?
It was just shambles. It was an absolute shambles, and that's why the team wasn't doing well, because there was so much stuff going off in the background, you wouldn't believe. I could write a book just on that. Those couple of seasons.
Yeah.
Because there was so many things that were going on.
Was that at the time where you sort of knew in your mind as well that you needed to get out and perhaps join someone else?
I was on a quite a long contract because Paul Sturrock, he re-signed me, so I was on probably like a 3-year contract, so I was gonna
tied.
Yeah, I was tied in, so there was no way of getting out. I know around the time when those Japanese investors, I think Sturrock had gone, I think this was around Paul Mariner time, the club wouldn't... I went to Ipswich, didn't I? But there was a chance the club could have made money off me to go to Bristol City. I don't think that would have gone down too well, because obviously, but it's not as bad as going to Exeter, is it? But they could have made money off me. I was coming to the end of my contract. There was probably like only about 5 months, 6 months left in the season, and Bristol City said they'd give the club money to buy me, and I thought, take some money and run. But they were like, nah, we want more. So I just thought it was just like, it's just bad business sense, like upstairs around that time. Yeah. You know, you got a Japanese guy who's living in Japan or somewhere. We only saw him probably once.
We've got a picture on the system, I think, of them arriving at one training ground
session. Yeah, I can't remember seeing the guy. So, you know, to have an investor or to have someone like that who's not there every day, not seeing what's going on, and then having some Muppets that are looking after the club that don't have a clue what they're doing.
Yeah.
It was a recipe for disaster, and that's what happened.
So did you sense that something like administration was coming then? No,
we didn't know until the PFA came in and said, okay, this is what's going on. So that brilliant.
Quite a shock.
Yeah, we were like, okay, great. So once that happened, I was like, okay, we're in for a, this is going to be bad, this.
Mm-hmm. For someone like yourself, though, I mean, you know, with due respect, you're earning a fairly decent wage. You probably were okay to get by. But for maybe some of the younger players and the staff at Argyle especially who weren't earning the same kind of money, it must have been difficult to see them struggle.
Well, I saved well. You know, I was a good saver. So I had a bit of money behind me to get through that time. What happened, actually, though, the PFA came in, and then the club loaned me out to Ipswich. No, I think actually I went to Ipswich and then we went in administration. I think that's what happened. They must have seen something happening because they sent me out to Ipswich on loan. And then it hit. And so I was there with Roy Keane, hoping to get signed. I think I would have signed as well if he stayed, and then he got the sack. So then I had to go back to Plymouth, and that's when it all started happening.
So were Ipswich paying the wages at that
point? Yeah, they were paying my wages, yeah. So I think I was there for 2 months maybe. So I had 2 months of, okay, I've got to get everything in place. A lot of the lads weren't ready for a bang and that, and a lot of them didn't have savings. So they were struggling. And then the PFA came in again and they were giving the lads money. So the PFA of, you know, so anyone can say what they want about the PFA, they've been brilliant.
Yeah.
Like during the, when it hits the fan, the PFA are there, you know, and they were giving out lads a lot of money.
Must be difficult to go into work though and seeing the staff, you know, that don't get that help from the PFA.
Staff as well, you know, they were struggling, but obviously there's always staff that don't get looked, you know, in every football club there's staff that don't really get looked after, and there's, you know, you always get the people that just
do it for the love, don't they?
They do it for the love and they get taken advantage of, you know. That's what I hated about football the most, was people that would give their time to the club, and, you know, football clubs would give them peanuts, really, and take advantage of people's time and their love for the club. Not going to go down there, but, all, you know, with what happened, there was a lot of people that were, you know, struggling, obviously. I think the problem was we didn't know what, you know, there wasn't much, the upstairs weren't talking to us very much. It was like, yeah, this is what's happening, okay, get on with it. And it's like, come on, it's more than that. It's, you know, it's people's livelihoods here. And
yeah.
And I guess you didn't know how long it was going to go on for.
We didn't know how long it was going to go on for. We didn't get a kind of concept of how long.
Or how bad the situation was.
So we're kept in the dark about that, you know. If it wasn't for that set of players, that club would have gone under, definitely. Because we were still playing, I think it might have been 6 months, maybe 7 months without wages.
I mean, were there any times where players had a discussion, look, should we carry on playing? I mean, did it ever enter the players' minds, should we carry on playing? Or should we?
Oh, there was loads of meetings, but I was one of the ones where it's like, look, end of the day, if we drop tools, this club's gone, and you don't get any money. Because we'd already been 2 months into it. I just felt like there was a few players that were like, let's drop tools. And there was a few players that was like, we're in it. We're going to have to get ourselves out of it. Obviously, we went down and we had a double relegation. It was a weird one, actually, because we got relegated from Championship. I played in the World Cup, got relegated from League One, so it was a crazy, crazy time. that should have been a time where I was flying, you know, but it was like a time of just like nightmare.
I remember, I remember the administrator coming in and saying he thinks it was the closest he'd ever seen one team come to actually going bust.
Oh, that if it wasn't for the players, it would 100% went bust, because they wouldn't have been able to afford the wages. It would have just completely gone. So I don't think, when I see like stuff with the fans and they're like praising like Peter Reid and stuff for that, he wasn't even there. Let me just put it out there. He was hardly ever there. He was there for the cameras. Like, that's the only time I ever saw the guy was at the cameras. It was the players that kept that thing going. 100%. If it wasn't for the players, there would be no club.
And that's, I guess, the relegations, you can almost take that in your stride, because there is to the club, you know. You've seen teams at lower levels go into administration, they just don't come back, and that's it.
There's some clubs that you'll never see again. Obviously, Plymouth had a fan base that was passionate about the club, and they wanted that club to keep going, and they were, you know, doing raffles and trying to do everything they could to keep the club going. But if it wasn't for them players sacrificing the wages and not getting paid, there would have been no team.
How hard is it for the players then to stay silent during that time, if all that's going on?
Well, you just got to be a pro, you know. End of the day, you're a professional. You've signed that contract with that team. You've got to, you know, you got to treat it with respect, you know. People are fuming, like, but it's just one of the things you just got to get on with. And, you know, it's very difficult to go on a pitch and play football when you know, just, you don't know what's going on.
Well, also, you could go on that pitch and get injured, and knowing that you're not going to get paid God knows how long.
Yeah, because the contract can get ripped up. Yeah. So you had all these scenarios going through in your head, like, what's going on here? Yeah, because the championship demotion was just down through, you know, it was performance-based and not having a good enough team. That's why we went down. The drop from League One was the administration that really did it, because we had a great team. If you remember that league, that League One team was a very, very good team. You look at some of them players, some of them played in the Premier League, most of them. So we had a very good team. There was no excuses there, but it was just one of them things that, you know, it's very difficult to play in those circumstances.
Like you said as well, Vienna had the 10 points that you would have stayed up as well. So yeah.
And the 10 points, yeah, I forgot about that as well. So we were under a lot, you know.
Was there nothing in your contract then, because you didn't get paid, that allowed you to walk away for free? I mean, we're hearing all these stories from Sporting Lisbon at the moment about players wanting to tear up their contracts because the fans there have been trying to assault them in training and stuff. There's a...
Unless we didn't get that trying to beat us up. Had a few fans that weren't happy, but obviously you're not going to be happy. But yeah, we could have ripped up our contracts, but we wouldn't have seen any of the money I had. For me, I had like a couple of years left in my contract. I think I had 2 years left. So I can't rip up a 2 year contract. I had to see it out.
So was that the toughest time of your career then, would you say? Or
pardon?
Toughest time of your career, the administration period? Or?
I think one of, yeah, definitely. That and probably Cruciate. Definitely the one of the most difficult, but you know, It's you know, when you go through hard times, you learn about yourself, you know.
And more probably than and you do more in the good times.
Exactly. So, you know, I had that kind of World Cup thing as well. You know, I had a down moment with the championship drop. I had this euphoric moment, which was like being on top of Everest. Like, when people ask me, it's hard to describe what playing in a World Cup is like. It's, you can never imagine it. It's like being on top of Everest and just seeing everything. And then obviously the next part in your is a descent down, and that's what happened with the League One and the administration, you know. So it was just like, it was a crazy time. Great to write a book about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you know, it was a mad time.
Well, we've got a couple of questions here. We'll do some quick fire questions, and then we'll come on to the World Cup. We'll have a little chat about that. Mike's asking, who is your favourite manager to work under at Argyle and why?
Ollie. Just because...
Would that be in your whole career as well, or just at Argyle?
Not my whole career, just at Argyle was Ollie. Yeah, he was, out of all the managers I had at Argyle, he was probably the best. Obviously, the results...
Yeah.
Just need to take a look at the results and where we were on the table before he left, you know?
What about in your career?
Ooh, difficult one. I've only had a handful of managers that I've had a lot of managers, but only a few that have that I thought, wow, they're proper quality. I don't like talking about managers because it's one of them subjects that, you know, players are never happy with managers, are they, if they're not playing, and they're happy if they're playing. You know, it's one of them fickle things where, you know, I could have had a great manager, but around that time I might have not been playing, so he's a crap manager.
Yeah,
it's very it's a fickle game when it comes to, you know, managers. So I don't like to tend to talk to about managers like that. Only ones that have, okay. You know.
Okay. Well, Mark's asking, what were your highlights of your time at Argyle?
Highlights was definitely around the promotion. You know, that championship time, and then a time where I was with Paul Sturrock and I was playing really well. Scoring, you know, I was doing well around that time, yeah.
I mean, is it frustrating
when the championship was definitely the highlight. Yeah. Yeah.
How much does not scoring when you're a striker play on your mind?
Massive. Yeah, it's massive. And then it gets bigger and bigger when you know the games are going past and you're like not scoring, it's horrific. Mm. It's the hardest position on the pitch. Definitely, 100%, because any other, you know, obviously goalkeeper, if you screw up, it's a big mistake. But you're not expected to score. And you're not expected to keep clean sheets every game. Whereas a striker, people expect you to score in every game.
Yeah.
They think they expect you to be Ronaldo. Especially if you're not in a great team as well and there's no chances coming. It's just like, you know, you've got midfielders there to create for you and they're not creating and you've got no chances and it's a nightmare.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier on about how you'd prefer, or sounded like you'd prefer to play with someone up front, so, you know, playing in a team that plays two up front.
I prefer playing two up front.
How difficult is it when you play that lone striker role? Because, I mean, that's pretty much what Derek Adams does.
The target man is pretty much doing donkey work, so you'll never be up with the play because you're holding pretty much everything up and you're laying stuff off for people to run behind you.
Yeah.
So you're hardly ever on the, you know, last man. Because you're expected to hold the ball up to get the team up the pitch. So there was a lot of times where I was playing up front by myself as well. I hated it.
And also, it seems like, you know, a defender can grab a striker, pull them out as much as
they want. Well, you've got 2v1 all the time.
You do something back to them and it's a free kick.
And then also when you try and shut down the goalkeeper, the two centre-backs split off and they just pass it around you. So it's you're just doing donkey work, really. I never enjoyed it, one up front.
Yeah, certainly a tough role to play. Dana's asking, who were some of your favourite Argyle players to play alongside and what were they all like as characters in the dressing room?
Man, at the very start, there were some absolute characters, man. Like Lillian Nellis, he was a character. He was hilarious, man. Yeah, people like Paul Connolly, Skelser, like, he was a character. My mate Luke McCormick, I loved him. He was probably my favourite player to play with was Luke. Yeah, I love Luke. There was a lot of players that went through. Jamie Mackey was a character. Even people like the physio, Paul Maxwell, he cracks me up. I still keep in touch with him today. But he was hilarious, man. There was people like the kit man, like Steve the kit man. You're probably out there listening, but he was a character as well. There was always people like around the background as well that were just like,
you know,
great characters in that, brilliant characters to have in that. And then when they go, it's just like something, you know, you lose something. I think for me, like in any team, you always have to have those characters, you know.
Yeah.
I think when Lillian and Paul Watton was a character as well. I think when them two left the change room, we lost a lot of banter and stuff like that. Obviously, you try and continue on, but yeah, when you have more people, you know, bantering each other, it's better.
Yeah.
You notice in any sort of workforce, if someone leaves, you know, an office and they were one of the central characters, and it all just goes a bit quiet.
Yeah.
It's not quite
the same. Yeah, definitely. It's you know, when, you know, the big shoes to fill, you know, those are the people that, you know, when you're having a tough time, it's like they make you laugh.
Through, yeah.
I think the, you know, there's always, you know, to get through stuff, especially difficult stuff, is laughter. That's why we're on the time of the administration. I was like, one of the managers said, why are you always happy? I was like, bloomin' hell. If you want to look in that change room, everyone's depressed. So I was like, I'm the only one that's trying to keep everyone going. So it's like, there was crazy stuff like that when saying, well, people, why are you so happy? I was like, gotta be.
Because
if I'm not happy, then everyone's going to be proper depressed. So yeah, there's a lot of things that went off, like, but yeah, losing big characters and teams are very difficult.
Yeah, because Argyle are going to lose Luke McCormick this year as well. So
yeah, he's a great guy to have in a change room. Yeah. Luke, he's top boy. For me personally, I thought he could have, you know, he's good for a few more years, but I'm not the gaffer.
Were you ever daunted going into a new dressing room, or do you get used to it pretty quickly?
At the start, when I was a young lad, yeah, massive, because you're just starting on your way and you've got men in there and you've got to try and get into the group, you know? And if they don't like you, it's lonely. But when I started getting older and that, I started knowing who I was and what I brought to the team and stuff like that, it was fine. But no matter what, every time you go somewhere new, and it's with anyone in any business or job, you go somewhere new, is the first day is always difficult.
Yeah.
We'd often have to sing songs though.
Sometimes you'd have to do a dance or sing a song.
Some of those initiations then? What are some of the worst ones you've had to do?
When I was at Barnsley. I'm not going to say too much, but there was stuff like you had to do a Christmas song, and there was one year where we were YTS and that, and they said the losing team has to run around Oakwell naked while we throw cold buckets of ice at you, of water at you, and so I was like, yeah, I don't fancy doing that. So I was like, there was a few New Zealand lads in that in the youth setup, so I was like, okay lads, we're going to do the haka. So I said to the softened up the pros and said, look, instead of having a song, we'll give you a haka. So we need all the New Zealand boys together. They're like, yeah, do it. So we got away with it with that one. So we did the haka and they were loving it. They were just like, everyone was buzzing. And then the lads started singing and singing Christmas songs and they're horrific. And I think Big Johnny Parkin, do you remember Big Johnny Parkin? He was one of them that had to go running around Oakwell naked.
Not on a match day though.
Yeah, it was not a match day. There was a few cleaners and that watching them, but the whole like backroom staff and that were there, and they're all in the tunnel like cheering them on and that. They're all naked except they had shoes and socks on. So everyone was cracking up, laughing, man.
Yeah, I'm definitely glad that doesn't exist in those environment.
Those days are over. You do stuff like that, you get blooming, you're being caught, man. Yeah, the stuff like that in football's gone, whereas, you know, it was brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, those times coming through. I feel sorry for the lads that come through now because it's not the same. You know, they have banter, but you don't have stuff like that. You had people getting chucked in boot skips, locking them and rolling them down the hill and that. Banging into a brick wall and that, so it's like, and then leaving them in there as well. It was all sorts going off, man.
You must miss that side of things, though.
Used to crack. It was brilliant, man. Yeah, it was funny as a kid growing up. You see some of the stuff and some of the stories, and that were just hilarious.
Of course, you ended your career with Torquay, which was another sort of strange time, I guess, or a strange club to be at, because again there was so much going on off the pitch, really.
Yeah, Torquay was a great one because I was, well, what happened, I was at you know, I got the injury, I had people telling me, you know, give up, retire, and I was like, nah, I've got a couple more years left in me, I'm gonna do it, I'm gonna get back in. And then I went to Bristol Rovers, signed, wasn't playing, I was just a squad member, but I was happy because it got me playing for New Zealand again. So I went into a tournament there and became captain of the team, and we won that tournament and the team went to Confederations Cup. So it was a great tournament to win. So we went to Confederations Cup and then I got an injury, a heel injury, and that set me back and I missed the Confeds. And so I was out for 7 months with that, with a heel injury. So that killed me. I missed the Confeds. And then I thought, you know what, and then I had that time with Truro. I absolutely hated it. It was just one of the worst things I ever did was go there. But I thought, you know what? I was injured at the time. I left. So I was on this like I was on this downer really. I was like, what am I doing here? Like, should I just pack it in? And then I started going to a CrossFit gym, and I was just like going there. I was doing, I was doing the cowlick and stuff like that. And I was just training there, and I started to get stronger and fitter. And I was like, you know what? I'm feeling good here. I'm like feeling really strong. And probably one of the fittest and strongest I've been for a while in that. And so then I was like, you know what? I'm going to just, I read an article, might've been in one of the newspapers and that, the gaffer at Torquay was looking for a target man. So I saw that, I was like, I'm feeling quite fit and feeling strong, and I feel like I got, a few more games left in me and that. I'll just hit him up, So I hit him up and went there on trial and played against Argyle in the pre-season.
I remember getting to them, and I said, and Chris Harrington turned to us and said, do you recognise who that is over there? They were talking about, that's Rory Fallon.
Yeah, so I was like, I'm feeling good, so go in and win in there. And I always knew I was going to be a squad player, but I always had in my mind the playoffs. The only reason why I was doing it was to get into this World Cup playoff against Peru. At the time, I knew it was someone going to be like the fifth best team in South America. So I was like, you know what, it could be Argentina. I was like, you've got to try and just push it one last. Because around that time, I was happy to just call it a day.
Yeah.
Definitely. Around Truro, I could have called it a day right there.
But did you just need that goal?
I needed that little goal to just say, you know what, that's in a couple months' time. Mm-hmm. If I'm in a professional team, I know I can get in that team and that squad.
Yeah.
To face either Argentina or Peru or someone. So I was like, it was worth me just like grinding it out. I didn't really want to play in those lower levels, but it was something that I could see there. If I'm in a pro team, that's given me a great chance to get back into the fold, So I went to Torquay, and then, the manager started speaking to me. I was like, brilliant, this is it. And then all of a sudden the manager gets sacked, and I was like, oh no. I was like, what's happening there? I'm like a month away from getting selected for the squad.
It was right at the start of the season,
right at the start. So I was like, man, I was like flying. So then I went to Darlington I told the manager there, look, I'm here just to try and get into this World Cup team. Because actually, it was only 2 weeks before the team was selected when the gaffer at Torquay, when he got sacked. So I was like, this is the worst possible timing for me ever. So I was like, I'll come and play a couple of games for you, try and get into this national team, and then I'm going to call it a day. And then eventually I played two games for them. Very difficult because it's even lower down, but I was like, okay, just don't worry about that. Just look at the bigger picture. Kept fit, kept positive, and then I got selected for the sit-up. So I was like, brilliant. That was my goal.
Yeah.
And so I knew 100%, no matter what if we won, I would have kept on going. I would have kept on going, but I had in my mind, if we lose, that's me done. And so I got to that that World Cup squad. I was one of the older players there. I was the one getting the lads going and, trying to help them along. I knew I was always going to be a squad player. After we lost that, hung up my boots.
Good, not a bad way to go out.
No. Great way to go out. World Cup qualifier, I'm happy with that. Kind of my mate Kerry Arneson, I said to him, look, you're at a World Cup, you're on top of the mountain, mate.
Yeah.
For me, you retire. Because I think there's a life of Panama that's going to retire after the World Cup. I was like, that's go out on a high.
Watching Arneson, though, I mean, obviously they played Argentina a week or two ago. He played really well in that game. And of course, they got a 1-1 draw as well.
Played really well, but, Argentina, I don't know what's going on for them, because for me, they're like one of my teams. I always pick them. Like, I've got like a little bet going on with the family, like, okay, Argentina's my team. It's only like for a chocolate bar and stuff like that,
When ice cream
and chocolate bar. But it's like, I don't know what's going on for them, but like, you know, can't take away from Iceland. They stuck to it and they didn't give up, and you know, they were my dark horse, and then they lost that game recently, and I was like, oh. And now they have to beat Croatia.
Yeah.
And that's going to be, because they're flying. They're absolutely flying. So, but I said to Arnie, I was like, Arnie, there's no way, you know, there's no way you're going to top a World Cup. No matter what you do, you cannot go any higher.
It's Nigeria they've got to beat, isn't it? So obviously Croatia beat them 3-0, didn't they?
Yeah, and they're looking all right as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, talking of the World Cup, obviously you were there yourself out in South Africa.
Yeah.
8 years ago now. Would you say that was the pinnacle? Well, you already said it was the pinnacle of your career.
It's the pinnacle. You can't. The only way you're going to beat a World Cup is playing in the Champions League. And even that is every year.
Yeah.
You know, you can play in the Champions League every year. And when people say, you know, European Cup final, World Cup final, come on. There's no comparison, man. You got the thing with the World Cup. There's only a few players that will ever play for the national team, and then you top that with getting into a World Cup. You may only have one spell where you get an opportunity to play in a playoff,
yeah,
or you know, in a qualifier, and to lose that. That's you done. You know, some players will never ever get that opportunity again.
Because another 4 years at least.
Another 4 years. Chances are you won't be there again. I had the opportunity of playing three World Cup qualifiers. And for me, that was, even the qualifiers were the pinnacles of my career. Because I went, you know, the second qualifier for Brazil, we played against Mexico. Playing at Aztec Stadium, 107,000. You'll never believe what it's like to play in front of 107,000 people, all Mexican.
Yeah,
it was just at the Aztec Stadium. It was like one of them fairy tales. I've always wanted to play on that pitch, and then to score in that playoff against Mexico. You know, so it was like for me around that time. It was like, okay, the playoffs. It was like an addiction. It was like, I need more of that. It's like you can't compare club football to that. It will never come close. Unless you play in an FA Cup finals, you know, something, playoff final, and that's the only way you could get closer to that. Yeah. And then to say, like, 8 years later, you're going to be playing, you know, you got another chance. You know, with that Peru game, we were one game away from a World Cup. So, you know, for me, it was like, lads, like, I'm not playing, but what I would do to play in this game, you got one chance. Some of you will never, ever get this opportunity again. One, you got 90 minutes. That first game at Wellington, we drew with them. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, you've set this up to do this, you know? And it's like, you get one opportunity. And obviously, for me, we didn't really perform at our peak. I thought we were like deer in the headlights, I think, with that game. We were a young team, and it was just like, it was just beyond us.
Yeah.
And I felt like Peru was their time. But it's like you don't get many opportunities like that, and it's very rare, you know, to get one game away from a World Cup. I've had the privilege of being in two, you know, the Bahrain game, we were one game from a World Cup, and that Peru game. Obviously, I was in the bench, but I didn't come on. But you know, great to be involved in that.
So, what was that Bahrain game like? You obviously got the goal that sent the team there to the World Cup.
Just another euphoric moment in my career, you know. It was just like, I think it's everybody's dream to either score in a World Cup or get your team to a World Cup, you know, score the qualifying goal. It was just like, it was just made for me, that.
Do you remember it well, or was it a bit of a hit?
I remember every single moment, yeah. It was just one of those things. Yeah, it was a euphoric moment when that ball went in the back of the net. But there was times where it was like despair as well, because straight after the half, we let a penalty go and they missed the penalty. Our goalkeeper saved it. So it was just like, it's down as one of the greatest sporting events in New Zealand history, sporting history.
Yeah.
And it is. It was just drama.
That says a lot when they're, you know, so big on rugby.
Well, they've had all these World Cup finals, but they say that the World Cup final didn't compare to that. The World Cup final win for rugby did not, the atmosphere did not compare to that Wellington game, and it didn't. I watched it on TV and I was just sitting in the seats.
I guess because you were the underdog, you know, no one expected you to get
there. No one expected us to beat Bahrain. You know, everyone was writing us off for that. Yeah, we're going to lose, but, you know, it's great to be there. But for me, I was like, no way, we're winning this. And it's like, the thing with rugby is like, we expect to win.
Yeah.
Whereas New Zealand in football, we, you know, would be lucky to even do well in a playoff. So to get that opportunity and to go to a World Cup was just like, boom.
And then not lose at the World Cup and as then, well. I mean, that exceeded all expectations, didn't it?
And I think for us, around that time, it was like, oh, but you're not as good as the 82 World Cup team, because that was my dad's team. So, you know, there was a lot of stuff in the press. We beat Bahrain. Oh, yeah, you beat Bahrain, but, you know, your qualification's not as hard as the 82 team. The 82 team went. They went through one of the longest qualifications ever in the history of the World Cup. They went on like a 30-game, something like that. It was 20 games. It was a lot of games. And they played a lot of big teams in that. So it was kind of, they were romanticising over this 82 team. So I was like saying to our team, I was like, we got to do well in this World Cup. And that will shut everyone up. For me, I was like, this World Cup team was like, this will be the best ever team I've ever played in. I was like, we've got to go to this World Cup and we've got to absolutely smash it. And I think everyone was on the same journey. Everyone was peaking. You know, Ryan Nelson was playing in the Premier League. We had Winston Reid, who was a young lad coming through, yeah, who was going to be in a Premier League player. We had like championship players, we had Premier League players, we had players, we had men in that team. And it was like, I was probably played 300 games by that point. You know, there's a lot of players that have played a lot of games. Most of the team were pros. Then on your bench, you got people working in a bank. And so, do you know what I mean? It was a crazy team. You had people working in a bank and there was like part-timers. But our actual first 11 was a bona fide, you know, men's pro team. Like, we were battle hardened, and I felt all the things that I lost in my club, I was like, I'm going to get it back through this, you know, doing this, you know, getting to this World Cup. And then we went there and we're just like, the atmosphere was unbelievable. And, you know, the three games, like, were just, when I, the first game, I was just running around in the daze thinking I'm playing in the World Cup. When I was a kid, I never, you know, I used to watch World Cup, and there was, in our family, you know, for everyone, the World Cup, everyone watches it. And watching all my heroes, you know, playing a World Cup, and then obviously I'm in a World Cup, and I'm like thinking, what am I doing in a World Cup? I was just thinking, how have I got here? I just thought, for me, it was a miracle, man. So to play, not just in a World Cup, you see Panama, first ever World Cup, but the way they've done it is like, you know, against that, you know, the England, they were rolling around, diving, and, you know, it just doesn't look.
Yeah, they said that in commentary, didn't they? They said, you know, it's great that they've got here, but the way they're here,
the way they conducted themselves, yeah, they don't look like they belong there.
Mm.
You know, it's one of them things that it's like, it's they'll end up with a bad taste in their mouth of, yeah, how they've conducted themselves. Whereas we went there, we just smashed it, man. But we went in those tunnels. Think, for me, in my head, I can't say about the other lads, but I know they're in the same zone. Was like, we were looking at that Italian team, we were saying, we're going to beat you. Like, they were giving it the big, you know, the big one, all arrogant, and we're world champions, you know, we're going to roll this team over. Because,
yeah,
that's what you could see. They were just chilling. But we were just chomping at the bit in that tunnel, like, just like, it's on.
So much for psychology in sport.
Oh, massive. It was massive, man. And we were just so hungry. It was a bit like when Iceland played England in the Euros. Yeah. It was like a mentality. You know, football, it's like, you have the wrong mentality and you go into football, you lose. 100%. Doesn't matter how good your team is. And just that time was just a special time.
Not only to be unbeaten as well, it's funny you finish above Italy in the table.
But do you know, if the first game we drew against Slovakia and we got a last minute goal in the dying seconds of the game. So we were lucky to get that draw. So for us, it was a win. The Paraguay, we were never going to beat Paraguay. They were just way above us. We did well to even, I don't even think we had many shots on it. You know, our team was like, we were a defending park the bus team, work on your set plays. We were one of them teams, but we did it well.
Yeah.
And we were getting people's faces. The Paraguay, I couldn't see us beating them, even if we went for it. I was a little bit disappointed because I felt that we could have gone for it and thrown like three players up front, like properly up front to go get that goal. But I felt the Italian game was the one where we should have won. And that was because they were never going to score except for that penalty. And that game should have been 1-0. If it wasn't for the tug. And that's the one where it's, you know, the small chances I'm saying about the percentages of playing in a World Cup and playing for your national team, and then the chances of getting through the next round was possible.
Yeah,
that's why for me at the end of it I was disappointed. Now I look back at it with fond memories, but at the time I was so disappointed because I felt we were good enough to get to the next round and we were a win away from it, and it was the Italian game that killed us. 100%.
You must have taken a lot of satisfaction from sending the Italians home, though. As you say, they went into the tournament as world champions, didn't they?
They went in world champions, and they, you know, they still had a great team. They had Cannavaro and Cellini at the back, man. You know what I mean? They had Pirlo on the bench. Do you know what I mean? They had De Rossi. Do you know what I mean? They had a good team. Materazzi there.
Were they the toughest team you think you played against? Or defenders, I should say, more so than the team.
Because physically I was stronger than them. I remember back in that time they were diving around and that, and that, you know, when you watch a World Cup and you see team cheating and diving, you know that mentally that whole team, they know that they're not good enough to beat them on a level playing field, so they have to cheat. And that's how I felt again with Italy. For me, that gave me confidence, because if they're trying to get us sent off and, you know, pretending to be injured, mentally we had them.
Yeah.
And it was just one of them things, they couldn't score, and it was the pen.
Do you actually get time to enjoy the World Cup while you're there, or is it
so? No, focused? It was just so focused. We were just so focused. We had the time of our lives. You know, we were having barbecues, like we were living in like million-dollar houses, they were multi-million houses. It was we were in Johannesburg, and there was 7-bedroom houses. And we were all in one street. So there was 5 players to 1 house. So we had it was a proper house, you know. You had barbecue out there, you had a swimming pool. We were just loving it. We were staying on the Serengeti Resort. So it was like a golf course there. It was a clubhouse. We had golf buggies. We were booming around everywhere. We were loving life.
Because you hear it quite a lot, you know. The England players recently have been saying, you know, you do get really bored when you're there because there's so much time to kill.
That's the thing, was like the best thing for us was that we were so relaxed. We were focused, but we were totally relaxed because of our surroundings. Whereas I think, especially New Zealanders, Kiwis, we need to be outside. If we're stuck indoors, we'd lose our minds, man. We need to be near the water. We need to, you know what I mean? It's one of them things that when you're brought up, that's what it's all about, being outside and that, and just enjoying having a laugh. If we were put in a hotel, I don't think we would have done as well, I don't think, because it is a nightmare being stuck in a hotel.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, it's just a world away from what you were living with through Argyle at that time as well.
It was totally opposite. So it was like relegation to being on top of the world, you know.
Yeah.
So what have you made of the World Cup this
love
time
it.
Around
love it.
When you watch Peru, though, is there a bit of, oh, that could have been us? Or?
No, because they're not doing great, are they, really? There's, moments where you keep an eye on Peru because they're the ones that knocked you out, you know? But they're just, you know, you look at them and, you know, they play come against other teams and they're not looking that great, you know?
They missed so many chances against Denmark, didn't they?
Missing chances and stuff like that. They don't look as, you know, as good as they, you know, did when they played us. But I think it was to be for them. You know, it's like, I don't look back and say, oh, you know, damn you, Peru. Do you know what I mean? It's like one of them things. It's just, it was meant to be for them, like it was for us against Bahrain. But I'm loving the World Cup. It's like, I think people find me a bit strange because I never watch football. The only time I watch football is World Cup, so I've been watching pretty much every game.
Do you have a soft spot for England?
Yeah, of course I do. I'm English, like my dad's English. Yeah. You know,
well, you play for the youth teams as well.
Play for the youth teams, of course. You know, I got, it's just like it's ingrained in me to what, like when I was a kid, it was English football. What, you know, it was Italian, you know, when I was growing up, and Dutch, but I was always English for me. It was like my dad's English, my grandma's English, my whole side of my dad's side's English, except for my granddad who's Irish. So for me, it's like England, like, you know, like when I'm always watching them. And I'm enjoying watching them, actually.
Yeah, I think everyone is.
We were speaking earlier that Gareth Southgate is definitely winning some of the doubters over.
I don't think Sam Allardyce would have done as good a job as him.
No.
I don't know if he could have, you know, he could get into these, speak to these young players in the way that, you know, Southgate would. You know, because he's young at heart. He's a young manager and, you know, wanting to do things.
He seems to be giving the players a lot of responsibility, like that free kick routine goal.
Well, some of those free kicks are unbelievable.
He said that, you know, the players are making the decisions on the pitch to as to what free kick routine they're going to try.
Some of the free kicks have been quality. They should have left a couple of them to the bigger games, I think, because one of them worked perfectly against Panama. I think they should have maybe left that for the... Because that penalty, the one where they were like 1-2 and then they put it back.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about.
That was an unbelievable free kick. I was like, you've got to save that. You know, you've got to save the good ones for like when you need it. Not when you're winning like 6-0, 5-0 and stuff like that. You know, you've got to save
it. By all accounts, I think Steve Holland, the coach, is behind a lot of the free kick routines. And he's pretty big on set pieces.
The way that Gareth Southgate and the team have dealt with everything, the media, I think everything's been perfect.
Do you know what I find, though, with this team is that I don't know many of the players, for me. So you haven't got these household players. The problem with, like, you know, the golden generation, you have these household names who, like, everyone knows and they're expectant of them to do well in a World Cup. Whereas this one, just coming up to this World Cup, I didn't even know there was a World Cup on in England.
Yeah.
Like, there's been no, like, publicity for it whatsoever. And it's been a completely different... It's been a complete change and it's been great because I think it's put less stress on the players.
Yeah.
And I think they've gone into that really free instead of going into a World Cup where when you're feeling tight like that, you don't play your best.
It probably goes back to what you said about Italy earlier on, then they're not going
expected to go there and kill everyone. The world champion. And it's like Germany, you know, they struggled in that first game. Argentina. You go to Argentina, they did a minute silence for the team that lost, and for them losing. Yeah. They're under massive pressure.
Yeah.
They're like England, they're expected to win the World Cup.
Yeah. Well, you even saw it with the Argentinians, you know, Messi before the game was rubbing his face.
Yeah, they're under severe pressure.
All of them.
And it's like, you multiply that, you know, for me, there was stress, but it was like a freedom in the stress. Yeah. Whereas these guys, it's every move is scrutinized in the press. Like, you're just dismembered and they'll pick parts out of you. You know, when they're doing a minute silence, you know, on the TV, you know, you're under serious scrutiny. Yeah.
And they've still got a chance to qualify, you know. If they beat Nigeria,
so I need them to qualify. You know?
They got a chocolate bar.
Yeah. But I was thinking, you know, I should have picked England. They're flying, man.
Yeah.
But obviously, everyone's saying, oh, it's Panama. Right? Yeah, but you still need to beat these teams.
Yeah.
Do you know, they could have gone into that game. They didn't go into that game thinking, we're going to beat you. They're going into that game, we have to win. Whereas I feel like it's a complete different change from when they were in. It was a transitional time where the old guard and the new guard were mixing, and
Southgate's done away with all the old guard now, hasn't he?
You've got to, sometimes I think it's best to have a clean break and just start with a brand new team, like Germany did when they won that World Cup. They had a brand new team, they were a young team, and they just went through with that team. And I just think, like, you know, you got to get rid of the, you know, it's like me and the New Zealand team. I knew it was time for me to move on. There was no more, you know, for me, I was quite a big name in that team because of what I did in the World Cup. So I knew full well, it's time for me to move on after this and let, you know, the young lads kick on now. But they look like they've got a freedom about them. They haven't been put under the test yet.
Yeah.
Obviously, they will be soon. Like, well, Belgium will be a great indication of where we are. You know, where England are.
Even that, though, I mean, you know, it's a bit of a dead rubber. It's going to be against the second string
Belgian team, probably. And possibly the England team will be using
the
subs and utilizing that as well because they're through. So
do you think that's what we'll do? freshen it up a bit? Or?
I'd freshen it up a little bit. Give people like Vardy, a couple of strikers a go. And saying that, depends on what Harry Kane, he might say, look, I want to play, I'm hot, because he's gunning for a golden boot.
Yeah. Well, Jack and I were having that same conversation before we came on air. And you were saying, Harry Kane's going to be after that golden boot. But I was saying, but the team's got to come first. It's 100% the World Cup.
The team comes first, but it really depends on how he's feeling after those games. After them two games, because he might be a little bit tired. You know, as a player. But for me, I'd be wanting to play every game.
These are decisions a manager gets paid to make. Some of the pundits were saying the wide break a team that are doing so well, keep it going, keep momentum.
And, Andy's the captain as well. For me, I'd want to keep playing because, his third goal, that's when you're on a hot streak, when someone's kicking at you and it goes in.
Looking at the goal, comes
off your heel. You didn't even know about it. So, he's flying, man. I'd keep going. For me personally, I'd probably change a couple of players, but I wouldn't change it too much. But I'm interested to see how England do. I hear everyone saying it's coming home. They've got a long way to go before it comes home.
Indeed. We're not normally this happy after two games, though.
No. Usually it's doom and gloom.
Four years ago at this stage, we were already out of the tournament, weren't we?
Yeah.
So, progress.
Long may it continue.
Indeed. Right, well, that's all we've got time for. Rory, thanks ever so much for coming in. Been an absolute pleasure to hear all your stories, and some of them brilliant, some of them not so great from your time at Argyle. As always, we appreciate any guest that comes in, so thanks very much for joining us. Jack, thank you too. That's all we have time for. We'll be back again same time next week. Bye-bye.
We are always happy to hear from you, and if you have any questions for our panel, please tweet them to our Twitter account @HeraldPAFC or visit our Facebook page, Plymouth Argyle The Herald. Thanks for listening.